Another Path to Affordable Healthcare, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. As the latest GOP healthcare proposal is unveiled, we look at how another country's managed to deliver high-quality care at an affordable cost.
For almost all minor problems, cuts, sore throats, people pay out of pocket. On the other hand, if you have a catastrophic illness and you are hospitalized, you get heavily subsidized hospital care.
Stay with us to find out where and whether or not a similar plan might work here. Plus, the Gambia loses a lot of its young men to emigration. To stop that, this local artist says you need more jobs.
Because if you have work to do, every month you get your salary, of course you will stay here. No place is like home.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. In a few minutes, we'll head to Iraq to get the latest on the fight against ISIS in the city of Mosul. But first, a story closer to home. After weeks of closed-door meetings, Senate Republicans today unveiled a draft of their plan to overhaul the Affordable Care Act. The measure would kill a tax on wealthy Americans that helps fund it, and it would slash Medicaid in a bid to cut costs. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell said it's a good plan.
We agreed on the need to free Americans from Obamacare's mandates, and policies contained in the discussion draft will repeal the individual mandate so Americans are no longer forced to buy insurance they don't need or can't afford, will repeal the employer mandate so Americans no longer see their hours and take-home pay cut by employers. It will eliminate costly Obamacare taxes that are passed on to consumers so we can put downward pressure on premiums.
But Democrat Chuck Schumer said the Senate's version is even meaner than the House's.
This bill will result in higher costs, less care, and millions of Americans will lose their health insurance, particularly through Medicaid. It's every bit as bad as the House bill. In some ways, it's even worse. The president said the Senate bill needed heart. The way this bill cuts health care is heartless.
For more on the Senate's plan, you can visit PRI.org. As the debate over health care continues here in the U.S., let's take a look at one country that's managed to keep the quality of health care high and the costs low. That country is Singapore. For more, we turn to William Hazeltine. He's the author of Affordable Excellence, The Singapore Healthcare Story. He's a busy guy. We caught up with him during lunch at a New York restaurant, and we asked him how Singapore's healthcare system works.
Singapore's healthcare system is fundamentally a government-controlled system, but the access to primary care is out-of-pocket payment. So if you have something minor, you pay yourself. However, the government forces you to save for that eventuality. So you take some part of your salary and put it into a savings account, which is to be used for your health. If you have a catastrophic illness and you are hospitalized, you get heavily subsidized hospital care.
And Singapore also takes a role in controlling the price of health care and the kind of drugs, et cetera, that it will actually cover.
It does. Singapore is very controlling on price and even the number of doctors that are allowed to practice in Singapore. They believe that there's something called doctor-driven healthcare demand. So the more doctors you have, the more health-seeking behavior you will encourage. So they control the number of doctors, the number of hospitals, the type of equipment that can be in a hospital, the number of drugs, and the price of those drugs. And they assure that no one in their country is without health care. If your income doesn't quite bring you up to where they think you need to be, suppose you're 75 years old and you've stopped earning money and you are likely to need more health care, the government may add to your private savings account $100 a month.
Now, given that the system has worked so well in Singapore, is there one lesson we can take away as the debate over healthcare continues in our country?
I think there are a couple of major lessons. The first and foremost one is you can deliver high-quality healthcare at about 25% of the price that we do. We know other countries like ours, developed countries, deliver much better quality healthcare than we do at half the price. There's a very sobering report done by the National Academy of Medicine. It's titled U.S. Healthcare in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, subtitled Especially for Women. We do very poorly and we pay more than twice of what everybody else pays. So the first lesson is it is possible to organize world-class health care at about a quarter of our price. The second lesson I would say is one way you do that is for almost all minor problems, clinics, cuts, sore throats, people pay out of pocket. I think that's a lesson we can learn.
But isn't the other lesson that the government has to take a strong role in trying to keep costs down and in establishing a system that is subsidized and that the government has more of a say than Americans seem to be willing to support?
I agree with that. And let's take another country altogether, Japan. Japan spends more, but not like 8% of their GDP instead of 20% of the GDP that we do. They have excellent health. Their system is government paid for and private sector delivers. And they control costs by controlling price. It's, again, a highly regulated system where they 1 year will control the price of the doctor, the second the price of medicine, the third the price of hospital services, and then they'll do the whole thing over again. So you can manage if the government is willing to be highly interventional and manage healthcare. If you have a system like ours, in which the government pays but doesn't manage, you have an uncontrollable system.
People who lean politically left in the U.S. will point to Canada, the U.K., other models of a single-payer national healthcare system. People who lean right in the U.S. really love the Singapore model. Are they getting it right?
They're not getting it right because they don't understand how interventionist the Singapore government is. It is interventionist to the maximum, much more than Sweden, Japan, or any other country.
William Hazeltine heads Access Health International. He's also the author of the book Affordable Excellence, The Singapore Healthcare Story. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
As I mentioned earlier, the battle is still raging in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. ISIS militants are cornered in the old city. Iraqi and coalition forces are advancing slowly, capturing as little as one city block per day, if that. And ISIS fighters continue to strike back. Yesterday, they appear to have detonated explosives in Mosul's 12th century mosque. That iconic structure with its famous leaning minaret is now in ruins. Nabi Boulos is a special correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He left Mosul on Tuesday and says ISIS is using everything it has to hold on.
Talking about the use of 23 millimeter guns, so the stuff that's used for anti-aircraft. We're talking about swarms of suicide bombers. I mean, they're no longer using car bombs now because there's just no space. So they're using, you know, snipers by the ton. It's been really very, very hard going.
You were with the Iraqi army as they're trying to kind of move in inch by inch to the old city. Visualize that for us. How is that taking place?
Essentially, it's Stalingrad-esque. Almost no building has been left unharmed. So, I mean, the place is obviously a morass of masonry and twisted metal. And so people are, I mean, the soldiers are, of course, creeping along, as you said, but they're also dealing with snipers and suicide bombers. And so therefore, they're being very careful. But the problem is compounded by the fact that you have civilians, lots and lots of civilians. And the moment they see an opening, many of them run toward security forces, which means that they have to struggle to actually decide who is friend or foe among the swarms who are coming to them. And that's why it's also very difficult. I mean, we're talking about a situation where they have to call in airstrikes very often just to be able to advance. And of course, we're talking about different groups here. I mean, you have the Iraqi army, but then you have the special forces groups that are doing a better job in terms of advancing, but they have to wait for the others to secure their flanks. So really, it's been very, very hard going.
I know you left just before the destruction of the city's iconic Nuri Mosque. Tell us the sort of symbolic importance this mosque held for the residents of Mosul and really for all Iraqis.
Well, I mean, the mosque and the minaret that is attached to it, which is called the Hadba or the Hunchback, I mean, these have been the icons of Mosul. Mosul, in fact, was often called Al-Hadba instead of its name because the monument was basically synonymous with the city.
And that minaret, it's called the Hunchback because it leans.
Yes. I mean, at the time when it still stood, it was listing and there were efforts to try to save it by different aid groups. Then, of course, Islamic State came in. And supposedly the group had actually placed mines around it back in the day. I mean, it's actually kind of a surprise that it had lasted, you know, so long and had still been standing.
It sounds strange to me that ISIS militants, which are supposed to be religious, destroy a mosque. Explain that for me.
They don't care if they destroy it. Yes, you're right. It has symbolism. Yes, it's an important place because it was where the group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, had given his first speech as a caliph. But at the same time, if it's a function of denying Iraqi troops a symbolic victory, then they'll do it, I think, without hesitation. But it should also be said that Islamic State has blamed the coalition for it.
How was the mosque actually toppled?
So the footage that we've seen, and again, this is secondhand, so I can't confirm it myself. You see the mosque still standing, and then you suddenly see this series of explosions along the mosque's minaret and then ripping through the rest of the structure. And then it collapses to dust. Based on that footage, it was a controlled explosion by Islamic State. Now, but again, they say that it was an airstrike that did it. So,
what's your sense of how and when this might end, this advance on the old city of Mosul?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, these things are very hard to gauge, so I'm a bit hesitant to give you a firm answer. But I'd be surprised if they managed to do it before a month, to be honest with you. It's just very, very hard going, and their intention is not to come out with the city completely destroyed and all the civilians dead. I mean, if they had, then they could have just carpet bombed the place and be done with it. But the fact is they're going to have to go by foot and clear the place room by room, and this is very difficult.
Can you tell us about a conversation you might have had with someone who fled the old city?
You know, as we were advancing through the different neighborhoods, you would see civilians taking the chance to run away. I mean, there would be a lull in the fighting or something, and they would just run and flee towards the security forces. And so then they can be given aid and taken to somewhere safe. And many of them have spoken about horrific conditions inside. I mean, one lady told me that they had to sell all their belongings so they could basically get 6 jerry cans of water. I mean, there's no fresh water, it seems. Food, of course, is very expensive. I mean, you see many of these refugees, basically just grabbing at the food and they're quite hungry. It seems to have been really, really desperate.
Are many of these civilians who are coming out of the old city of Mosul, are they also wary of the Iraqi troops?
For sure. I mean, they've been hearing for the last 3 years that the security forces will kill them. And let's not forget that the Iraqi army's history in Mosul, even before its fall into the hands of Islamic State, was not very good. You know, there's a reason why the Islamic State was able to basically take over Mosul with a skeleton force of fighters. That's because, the people there they had enough of the Iraqi army. And for them, anyone that came was seen as a liberator. But with that being said, I mean, many of them now have a different tune. And yes, they're wary, but for them, it seems that it's better to come to the security forces than to stay under the militants.
And is their next stop a refugee camp?
For a lot of them, yes. I mean, the men are rounded up and are then checked for links to Islamic State, you know, on this database that they have. But yes, I mean, for most of them, they end up going to a refugee camp until they can return. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there have been people who have returned even to some neighborhoods of West Mosul to check out their areas after they've been liberated by the Iraqi forces. So, I mean, there's a chance they can return, but it'll be a while.
Nabi Boulos is a special correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much, Nabi.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
An update now on a story from Mosul we brought you yesterday. We interviewed American relief worker David Eubank. He walked through a hail of ISIS gunfire to rescue a 6-year-old Iraqi girl. The girl's family had been shot as they fled a Mosul neighborhood. She survived by hiding beneath her mother's hijab. Today we tracked down Major Nassim al-Kafaji on the outskirts of Mosul. He's the chief medical officer of the Iraqi Army's 36th Armored Brigade. He's been watching the little girl adjust to her new life under the care of local elders.
The old woman now is take care to her, you know. Our neighbor have a little girl, same age, you know.
So she has someone to be with.
Yeah.
In the days after her rescue, the 6-year-old had been too stunned to talk and wouldn't even tell people her name. Major Al-Kafaji says her new young neighbor coaxed the name out of her.
When she asked her about her name, she said, my name is Tiba, and she speak but little. She now is better.
A small step for a young child still completely in shock. Coming up, how immigration is changing life in the Gambia, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. We're going to spend the next few minutes in an unlikely place, the Gambia. The small West African nation is home to less than 2 million people. It's one of the world's poorest countries, and for the past year, there's been intense political upheaval. Many hoped the country's new leader, Adama Barrow, could turn things around. But now there's a general feeling of disappointment. Change isn't coming fast enough. Little wonder, then, that the Gambia accounts for a high proportion of the migrants crossing the Mediterranean to reach Europe. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil traveled to one village in the Gambia to see how it's been impacted by that migration.
If there's a place that tells the migration story of the Gambia, it's the village of Badibou Saba. Most of the men and young men here have left for Europe, which may explain why I've mostly seen women and children walking around. Now there's greenery and agriculture surrounding the village, but inside it's dusty. I'm here to meet an elder to know why so many young men have left.
My name is Lang Sengate.
Thank you so much for having me here. And let's take a walk around the village a little bit. How many families live here? How many people?
A lot of families are here, almost 1,000 families. And the village has a population of almost 3,000 people, men and women.
So it's a big village. It's interesting, though, you're saying men and women, because mostly women that I see. Where are all the men in the village?
So many people have crossed the ocean to Europe, some through the back way, some direct flight because they have visa, but majority of them went through back way.
And the back way, that means illegally through smugglers, migration, through the Sahara.
Illegal migration, sir. Yes. Some of them may be forced to sell their father's cattle or so, and then put them the money together, and then just one day they disappear. Even the father may not know where the person has gone. So after several days or months, some will send text message that I am now in Italy or I'm now in Libya and so on and so forth. In the past, the desert was the favorite route, but right now they prefer going through Libya and then cross the ocean.
What effect did this have on the village, all these young men leaving?
It has a significant impact in the village because throughout, nearly every household has something to depend on other than their own agricultural products, because of expecting that any time I need money, if I call, it will be available. The village has changed also.
In what way?
In the way that now we have more cement blocks, more permanent buildings, and life is going on very fine. Everybody is delighted because when food is available and you live in a good house, concrete house, life expectancy is even supposed to be higher.
Let's speak to some of the women there. There are some of them sitting just opposite us outside a house. Assalamu alaikum. How are you?
Fine.
So tell me, are there any men in your family that are in Europe at the moment?
There are some who are in Europe. Two people. One in Greece, one in Spain. They are my born sons. They all went through the back way illegally, and they are now there. All the two of them have now got papers.
I noticed that your house is one of the concrete houses, and it's one of the big houses in the village. Has your life improved since your sons left for Europe?
The sons are in Europe. Whenever they have any amount, they send it to the family to supplement for the daily food and so on. When they have money, they send it to us. And when we have urgent need of money, we just phone them, and then within 10 minutes or so, we get a reply.
Thank you for speaking to me. Now, Lang, Kadekante's story is one example of many families here. And if you have a message for the president, what would you tell him? What are your demands?
What I'll advise him is to make sure that jobs are created for young people especially, and to care for the elderly, to make sure that they are also living a comfortable life, and for him and his government to make sure that they have the interest of the people at heart.
One of the elders in the village of Badi Busaba in the Gambia, ending that report from the BBC's Shaima Khalil. She's been in the Gambia talking to people about their hopes for change under the new president there, Adama Barrow, and, as we just heard, about how migration is draining the country. We're going to hear another voice on that subject now. Gambian rapper Bro K told Shaima about a song he wrote. It's about the illegal migration path known in the Gambia as Back Way.
The song is called Back Way. So I see people traveling from Africa to Europe, and
We see so many young people, you know, lost their life there, and their parents have only those people. We come as we are the voice of the voiceless.
And back way, of course, is the illegal way that young men take to get to Europe.
Yeah. So we are here to talk to our fellow Gambians and even non-Gambians, like the whole Africa. Let's do something. Let's our leaders let them consider youths because they're the future of tomorrow.
What if someone is listening to you and says, hang on a minute, I understand what you're saying about the back way, but this is the only way for me to get a better life, to get better prospects, to get a better job. Why should I stop? This is my only way, my only hope.
Yeah, you're still, you know, if you think that is the only way for you to go to back way, that is the only way for your success, you know what I'm saying? But it's something like it's illegal and it's risky, you know what I'm saying? You could lose your life or need, anything can happen to you. So I guess you stay at home, work, and still life goes on.
If you had a message for President Adama Barrow, what would that message be?
President Barrow, I would tell him that, okay, people are crying for electricity now, and youths are complaining about work. We need job. So let them try and bring those things right now.
So that people don't have to go to Europe illegally?
Go the back way illegally, you know what I'm saying? Because if you have work to do, every month you get your salary, little salary, of course you will stay here. No place is like home.
Can you give me a little taste of the song and how it goes?
Yeah. Ko mojella fata je men yale bama be jikri da mala jang e abala fa le warta mojella fata je men yale bama be
jikri da mala jang. Gambian rapper Bro K speaking with the BBC's Shaima Khalil about his song on the subject of migration called Back Way. I'm Carol Hills. A lot of factory workers voted for Trump because they liked his message about keeping U.S. jobs from going to Mexico.
I thought, you know, it's about time. We're the greatest country on earth. Why not?
So why do many of them still support Trump, even though as president, he hasn't saved their jobs? Our story from Indiana, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Ford Motor Company has chosen China over Mexico as the location of production for the next generation of its main small car, the Focus. Previously, the company had planned to use a plant in Mexico to supply the North American market, but according to an announcement made this week, by 2019, the Ford Focus will be built in China and shipped back here for sale. Meanwhile, the current Focus factory in Michigan is to be retooled to make trucks and SUVs, which are more profitable. Christian Zizek is a director with the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I asked her why Ford would choose to move part of its operation to China.
Ford is actually consolidating production of their Focus at a production site in Europe and one in China, so in Asia. Those markets do buy small cars on a fairly steady basis, and the North American market is pretty fickle for small cars. When our gas prices are low, they don't sell very well here.
They were going to do the Focus in Mexico, but they decided to do it in China instead?
Right. So Ford had a plan to build a brand new plant to build small cars in Mexico. And that's the plant that got pulled back that President Trump heralded as, you know, great news for American economy. That Focus, the model, was still going to be built in Mexico at the Hermosillo plant, which is an existing plant. And then the plant here that makes the Focus in Michigan would be making these new models. And I'll say the big change with that is actually maybe a net positive for jobs in the U.S. because the Focus is a global car, as I said, built in Europe, built in Asia. It's got a very global supply chain. And, you know, a global supply chain means lower U.S. or North American content in that vehicle. The Bronco and the Ranger are going to be more specific to the North American market, and that means a regional supply chain here in North America and perhaps even more jobs.
Do Trump's threats to rework NAFTA have anything to do with this? I mean, does the uncertainty make China a more attractive place?
Well, the Focus is already a very good selling vehicle in the Chinese market, so they're already building there for China. The quality is improved greatly, and they feel that it's time that they can bring that in from China to the U.S. and be competitive with other small cars in that segment. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty right now around NAFTA, around the potential for action on steel and aluminum, on, you know, tax reform, on fuel economy regulations that are currently in midterm evaluation. So the auto industry sort of got a lot of, you know, balls in the air that were waiting for some certainty to come down. So I don't know that this plays with the uncertainty with NAFTA, though. I mean, you know, bringing an entire vehicle in from China is different than building it in Mexico within the NAFTA region, certainly, but I don't know that the uncertainty around NAFTA is what pushed this. This is a business decision to have two main production sites rather than three.
Kristen, what kind of car do you drive?
I drive a Chevy Equinox.
Good for you, you
Made
Michigan
in Canada
resident.
With a U.S. engine and a U.S. transmission.
Right. Kristen Zizek is a director with the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's another story that involves manufacturing jobs, promises, and President Trump. It's about the Carrier plant in Indiana, the focus of a lot of attention in past months. The World's Jason Margolis has this profile of two workers in Indianapolis.
First, the backstory. Last December, President-elect Trump came to the Carrier factory in Indianapolis to deliver the big news. 1,100 jobs weren't going to Mexico. Trump had used the bully pulpit and state tax incentives to help accomplish this. After local union leader Chuck Jones heard Trump speak, he told a Washington Post reporter this.
I told her that Trump lied his ass off, that it was a dog and pony show, and that it almost threw up in my mouth.
Jones said Trump had exaggerated the numbers and left out key details. 1,200 Carrier jobs were still headed to Mexico. Trump responded via Twitter. He wrote, quote, Chuck Jones, who is president of United Steelworkers 1999, has done a terrible job representing workers. No wonder companies flee country, exclamation point. I asked Jones about being singled out by the most powerful man on the planet.
I'm not a soft person as I was. So, you know, what he said, I just thought was amusing, but, you know, I didn't feel like he was picking on me, you know.
But he's the president of the United States.
Yeah, that's true, you know. I just thought it was pretty chicken for the most part.
So that's the backstory. The feud between the local union president and the soon-to-be president of the United States quickly faded from the spotlight. But Chuck Jones hasn't gone silent. He's writing local op-eds saying Trump can do a lot more.
UTC, the known carrier, has got over $5 billion with a B in military contracts. If I was Trump, I'd have said, hey, you know, you guys have got over $5 billion in military contracts. You know, you might want to reconsider because you might be losing in the long run.
An interesting idea, but easier said than done. Military contracts are complex and take decades to complete. If a president threatened to unravel a defense contract to save unrelated manufacturing jobs in Indiana, that would almost surely be stopped by the courts. Jones acknowledges that a president, any president, can only do so much. It would take Congress, new policies, and years of work to make manufacturing in Indiana great again. And robots are replacing a lot more American workers than Mexicans are. Knowing all of that, Jones says this about Trump voters.
They drink his Kool-Aid. I think at that point in time, they were stupid. Now, some people I talk to now tell me, well, you need to give him a chance. You know, if that's what they're saying now, they're not stupid. They're ignorant.
What was our other option? Hillary?
John Feltner is a registered Democrat turned Trump supporter. We sat on his front porch swing just outside of Indianapolis on a weekday afternoon. He's got a lot of time to do that now. He recently got laid off from Rexnord, making ball bearings. Feltner was earning $25 an hour. Finding a new job with comparable wages to support his family, that's going to be tough.
I just want to make a living and you know, keep what I got here going. That's all I ask for.
Trump has tweeted out about Rexnord, too, but the company doesn't seem to be listening. I asked Feltner if the president could do more.
Yeah, I think he could do more, but on the other hand, this has been an ongoing process. This hasn't just been President Trump. This has been all of our elected officials. that have allowed this to happen.
Did your job go to Mexico or to a robot or?
No, my job went to Monterey. Hell, they took our machines. They wanted us to train those people. They're chasing cheap labor, plain and simple. And it's pure corporate greed.
Beltner says he doesn't like how Trump exaggerated what he did in Indiana, and he's lukewarm on Trump's performance so far, but Beltner still believes in the message.
What he said struck a nerve with me, and I thought, hell yeah, you know, it's about time. And who couldn't believe, if you're an American, as putting Americans first? I mean, you know, we're the greatest country on earth. Why not?
Feltner and Chuck Jones might not see eye to eye on President Trump, but they say they're friends and union brothers. And for both men, the goal is the same, preserving middle-class blue-collar jobs. And both men agree on this, too. They don't want their kids to follow them into manufacturing. Here's Chuck Jones again.
If I could give any message to anybody, it'd be kids in school. They have to get a college degree in order to have any chance of moving forward.
Help me understand one thing. You're fighting for manufacturing jobs, but on the other hand, you say you know that machines are coming in to eventually replace these workers, and you don't want your grandkids to go into manufacturing because there won't be jobs. So what are you fighting for?
Well, we're fighting to keep what little we've got left.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Indianapolis.
Critics of immigration policies say that deportations can break families apart and force children to live without a parent. This week, we're following the story of a family that moved to El Salvador after the dad was deported there. Deepa Fernandez went to visit Andrea and Waldo Hernandez. They live in a small town about 2 hours from the capital, San Salvador. It's a place where different neighborhoods are controlled by rival gangs. Deepa picks up the story as the family is making the miles-long walk home from their daughter's school.
It's hot and humid. The afternoon sun beats down. After picking up daughters Andy, who's 9, and Lelix, who's 16, we're finally close to the Hernandez's home. Andrea, their mum, is pointing out the various gang houses.
And this lady here was recently arrested. So this was a big hangout. And now it's completely quiet and empty.
The gang hangout she's pointing to is on the very block they live on. There are a couple of guys milling about. They're looking at us. Luckily, a few steps later, we arrive at the family's home. Everyone's hot, thirsty, relieved to be inside. There's no kitchen or bathroom. A dining table sits next to a stove in the open patio area. There's a cinder block shower right next to the countertop space where food prep takes place.
We survive over here, you know. It's tough. Taking, you know, like cold showers and stuff. But at least we're together, you know. We're together as a family.
When Waldo was deported, Andrea and the 4 kids were on their own in Las Vegas. They struggled. It's a complicated story. Let me pull back here and tell you what happened. See, Andrea and Waldo were foster parents. The kind of foster parents who social workers would call when they had a high risk or emergency placement. They were trusted, Andrea says. But in 2013, they were arrested and charged with multiple counts of mistreating 2 foster children in their care. Both the Hernandezes say the charges were false, trumped up. But they did plead guilty to 1 count, failure to take a baby in their care into the hospital after he sustained burns on his legs. Instead, they treated it themselves with some creams.
The crime that we committed was failure to report. That's a misdemeanor in the state of Nevada. But they piled on charges on charges on charges.
Andrea says they got bad legal advice in pleading guilty. Despite her guilty plea, she decided to gather evidence of her innocence. So with the help of her best friend, she compiled a 100-page response with evidence rebutting each of the charges.
Our sentencing judge said, I've never seen anything like this. She said the community, she received more letters for us from the community than she ever received in her career, supporting us. And my answer, you know, I was able to answer each charge that they, and say, no, this is not, we did not do this, we did not do that. She said, but we had already pled guilty. So she said, I've never seen anything like this, but I'm giving you probation. She said, I've never seen the prosecution so totally opposite of what the rest of the community and what your records are saying.
While Andrea was released from house arrest and was able to get her own kids back from the foster system, Waldo was transferred to immigration detention. He had never regularized his status. So 25 years later, despite being married to a US citizen and having four US citizen kids, he was deported. Andrea was now solo parenting their four kids. Living on welfare was hard. So Andrea decided to bring the children to join Waldo in El Salvador. They're trying to make the best of it in this small town about 2 hours from San Salvador. But it's hard. Waldo hasn't been able to get a job. The family survives on the money that Andrea's parents send from the US and help from Waldo's relatives. The upside of not having jobs is the time they have to focus on the kids.
Hi, sweetie. Did you have a nice nap? Well, I thought it was cool because when I came here, I'd never seen one of these before.
16-year-old Lelix is at a large above-ground sink, which is so huge it's more like a bathtub, and it's full to the top with water.
And it was like really weird because you had to not turn on the faucet to get water to wash your hands. You had to get one of the wakas like this, and you had to like scoop the water out of the thing and like wash your hands in it. It was weird. I was like, what is this?
Same thing for the flushing toilet, she tells me, almost apologetically.
And then over here, it's like the bathroom. It's like a tarp, but then there's only a toilet in here.
Okay, you get the picture. Life is quite different to their five-bedroom, three-bath, three-story suburban Las Vegas home. They had a big-screen TV, giant sectional sofas, two cars. The American dream is what they had, her mum, Andrea, says. So what about school here, I ask Lelix.
It's hard for me to take the test, especially in, social studies and science.
Her forte is obviously English, but even that is hard here.
And the teacher doesn't speak English very well. And when they ask him, Mister, how do you say tortilla in English? And he said, you have to say tortilla. And we were like, no, you don't. No, nobody says that. If anything, they say it with like a weird American accent, say tortilla. But like, you know, it's not tortilla.
Her mom is watching on. She can see Lelix is making the best of her situation. And like her daughter, she too takes the glass half full perspective on their situation.
We have to find the positive in the situation because it's a situation that we're forced to be in. But there's so much good can come out of it, especially for the kids. Learning two languages and learning about another culture that outside of the United States. That the United States is not necessarily the dream that they tell you it is in school. That there's a whole other world outside.
No. Oh.
2-year-old Elijah is going for the television buttons.
Nope.
They all rush towards him.
And he has ice cream hands.
Life. For the World, Deepa Fernandez, Sinsantepeque, El Salvador.
Deepa's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation as part of its Adelante Latin America Reporting Initiative. It's been more than a week since the 24-story Grenfell Tower apartment building in West London was destroyed by a massive fire. But anger at how it happened continues to grow. The World's Leo Hornack reports from London.
This is the sound of a prime minister being greeted by residents at the site of a national tragedy last week.
All to the people!
The official death toll in the Grenfell fire is now 79, but it's certain to rise. We still don't know who all the victims are, and we may never know. Some families are thought to have been illegally subletting or living here without papers. But fury at how such a tragedy could be allowed to happen is mounting, and it's turning political. This woman was one of the demonstrators at a protest at the local government office near the tower a few days ago.
I think the anger is growing and I think we have a right to be angry. I think as Londoners we need to come out. Enough is enough.
Today, Prime Minister Theresa May announced what many had feared, that the insulation material which had been used to clad the Grenfell building and which is blamed for making the fire spread so far and so fast is also in use on other apartment towers around the country. Already 7 have been identified as using combustible material, and there are still 600 buildings potentially at risk. But that's only part of the reason this story has become such a big deal for Britain and British cities. In the last few months, you might have heard that we've had quite a lot happen here. We've had a general election and 4 separate deadly terrorism attacks. There's also something called Brexit negotiations about our entire economic future. But it's the image of the flames rising and wrapping themselves around Grenfell which has become symbolic.
This is the richest borough in our country treating its citizens in this way, and we should call it what it is. It's corporate manslaughter. That's what it is.
David Lammy is a Member of Parliament with the opposition Labour Party. He's one of many commentators who see the safety failings at Grenfell as a symbol of something profound. The rotting away of old government safety nets for the poor through privatisation and spending cuts. Since the 2008 financial crash, fire services and local governments have undergone huge cuts in London to save money and increase efficiency.
And there should be arrests made, frankly. It is an outrage. And we know as politicians that the conditions in this country are unacceptable. We built buildings in the 70s. Those 70s buildings, many of them should be demolished. They haven't got easy fire escapes. They've got no sprinklers. It's totally, totally unacceptable in Britain.
The government is trying to respond to that mood. Around $6 million have been promised to help survivors and their families. But many have said they're afraid to claim the money because of their immigration status. 68 apartments in nearby luxury buildings have also been promised to survivors. And the Prime Minister has apologised for the failings in the initial response. But for some survivors, it's all coming too late. Swazi Mukali is one of the volunteers working to distribute donations to former Grenfell residents.
Why are people sleeping in floors when there are housings available? But people on the ground are thinking, why can't this just happen? And if it's going to take the community to do it, then let's band together and make sure things are getting done.
For The World, Leo Hornack, London.
Finally today, President Trump might be restricting American trade and travel to Cuba, but the island still exports its rich tradition of jazz and Afro-Caribbean music, led by people like singer Daimé Arocena. The World's Maria Muriel caught up with her on her U.S. tour.
Daimé Arocena strolls on stage barefoot, beaming as her band primes an audience in Boston for 90 minutes of Cuban jazz. Her head is wrapped in a white turban and she wears a white dress, the color of Santeria, an Afro-Cuban religion born out of European Catholicism and West African Yoruba rituals brought to Cuba by slaves.
Santeria is the base of Cuban music, basically. Every single rhythm comes from the bata drum. So even if you are not singing a chant of Santeria, if you are playing Cuban music, there is a link with Santeria.
Elegua is a haunting track off her new album, Cubafonía. The Santeria link is evident here. At 23, Arocena is a new voice in a growing chorus of musicians influenced by Caribbean Yoruba traditions. She joins Ibeyi, the French-Cuban sister duo named after a deity, and New Yorican rapper Princess Nokia. Even Beyoncé has evoked Yoruba imagery, dressing like the goddess of fertility in her maternity photo shoot and her Lemonade music videos. But Arocena's relationship to Santeria is different.
In my case, I'm a practitioner, so there is a stronger connection. But at the same time, I don't push myself to write Santeria's music because I'm not a real knowledge about it, being honest. My link with Santeria is more musical. I fell in love with Santeria music before the religion.
She's a classical composer and director trained in Havana. She says she grew up around Santeria. Her parents practiced the religion, but she never paid attention to it. Then she entered a music contest.
I was looking for making something interesting and Cuban and pure to mix Cuban influences with classical music. And it was the moment that I discovered the treasure of Santeria's music.
This song, Elegua, is named after the Santeria god of crossroads. Arocena says Elegua can open up good doors and close bad ones, or vice versa. Cuban Laura Arocena is bringing on tour at a time when President Trump tightens Cuba policy. She isn't very political, but she does have one message for the president.
He's welcome in my house to discover Cuba, get a better idea about us.
For the world, I'm Maria Muriel.
And you can see Arocena's video for this song, El Legua, over at PRI.org. That's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.